In this hour of Focus 580, we'll spend some time talking about some current space topics. And in particular, we'll start out talking about an event that took place just last week when Michael Melville, a civilian test pilot, became the first person to reach space in a privately funded program. This was in a craft called Spaceship One, and the designers of the craft are one of a number of teams around the world that are trying to win a prize. It's a $10 million prize that has been offered to anyone who can do this. And essentially, the deal is you have to be able to put a crew of three into space or their weight equivalent, bring them back safely, and do it again within 2 weeks. Now, they apparently had some difficulties with the maiden flight of Spaceship One, and they probably won't be able to meet that requirement, but I know that a lot of people think that sooner or later, and probably it's going to be sooner, someone will achieve this. And it a lot of people say that it represents a turning point in access to space. In fact, one of the quotes I came across came from the Associate Administrator for Commercial Space Transportation at the FAA, Patty Grace Smith, and she said of this flight, "The flight today opens a new chapter in history, making space access within the reach of ordinary citizens." Well, maybe, maybe not. We'll talk about that in this part of Focus 580 as we welcome back to our program Robert Zimmerman. He is an award-winning essayist and has written a lot about exploration, particularly exploration of space, but also in other ways as well. He's the author of a book entitled Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8, and a book that we discussed here on this program not very long ago, which is titled Leaving Earth, Space Stations, Rival Superpowers, and the Quest for Interplanetary Travel. It's published by Joseph Henry Press and still out there in the bookstores if you're interested in reading it. And of course, as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Zimmerman, hello.
Good morning, David. I'm very glad to be here again.
Well, I really appreciate you giving us some more of your time. When I was reading some of the stories about this, and I think it's a fascinating story, and I thought, well, maybe we could find someone who could talk about this. And your name right came to my mind because I thought we had a pretty good conversation last time. So I'm really glad you can give us some of your time. Maybe we should talk about the Ansari X Prize and,
sure,
and how it came about. And I guess this was – it's been on the table now for quite a few years.
Oh, almost more than – I think almost more than a decade. It was first proposed back in the early 90s, I think. I was still in – you moved from New York to – Maryland in around 98, and when I was in New York in the late 80s, in fact, I knew about the X Prize. They had been pushing this for years, and it's gone through several phases, new financing, new deadlines, but it really became really solidified and became somewhat serious since the turn of the century. And I should make some give a little bit of corrections. You were giving a summary of the prize itself. And the Spaceship One flight was actually not flying for the XPRIZE.
Oh, okay.
No, no. Their goal is to – they're designing the ship to win the XPRIZE. But the XPRIZE rules state that you must announce your first flight 60 days prior to its flight. And I think that one of the reasons the XPRIZE's goal is to encourage and create enthusiasm for the idea of private enterprise in space. And they want – the competitors to announce the date far in advance to build up some excitement towards the event. Scaled Composites, the company that flew Spaceship One, did not do that this time. This was basically a proof of concept flight. They were trying to make sure that everything was working, and of course it's still the design phase. Not everything was working.
Well, and I guess also it didn't meet the weight requirements because it had the pilot. It had Mr. Melville, but it's supposed to be either the pilot and two passengers or the weight equivalent of three people, and
that's
I don't
correct.
Think it met that requirement either.
That's correct. And so this was a proof of concept. The first time, they had done a previously about a month earlier, they had done a flight that got them up to 40 miles. Melville flew to 40 miles, and then about 2.5 Machs, 2.5 times the speed of sound, which at that time was a record for a private pilot, private plane. But this flight was to see if the design could get to 100 kilometers or 62 miles, which is considered to be the official barrier or border by rule makers in the international world for the, you've entered space once you've topped 100 kilometers. And they proved that their ship can do it. I mean, I can tell specifically of some of the problems they had. These problems did come up on the first flight, but it did come up on the 40-mile flight, but this did come up here. A fairing, which is kind of like a cover that's right next to the main nozzle of the spacecraft, actually collapsed soon after the engine cut off. And that needs to be replaced, and they have to figure out why that happened. But more importantly, the system that controls the craft's roll. Now, for those that don't know, there are three. You're working in three dimensions when you're dealing in space. You've got roll, you've got pitch, and you've got yaw. Now, yaw. If you take a pole, the roll is easy. It's just if you roll the pole across the ground. That's what roll is. Pitch is up and down. If the two ends can tilt up and down, and yaw is side to side. And so they have systems to control this orientation so that the craft will travel in the direction you want it to go. The way Spaceship One is actually the second stage of a whole system. The first stage is called White Knight, and it literally takes off from a runway with Spaceship One attached underneath it. When Spaceship One was released at about 46,000 feet elevation, its rocket engine, single rocket engine, then fires. When it fired, the roll systems that control the roll of the craft were not working properly. And Melville, who said later that he really thought for a few moments he was going to die, the craft started to roll as he's going up. So he had to manually put some control over that. And for that reason, Spaceship One didn't quite fly the exact course as planned. It didn't get quite to the altitude that they had planned. They had actually wanted to get up to about 110 kilometers, and they ended up going only about 100 yards, 300 plus feet above 62 miles. They just made the record, and that was because of the problems with the roll system. And that's actually, in a sense, a more serious problem than the other one. They have to figure out why the roll system failed, because that's life-threatening. You know, the ship has to be dependable. You have to be able to control it. But they were able to. Melville was able to bring it back. You know, he talked about how when he got up to the high elevation, he could see the curve of the Earth. He could see the black sky above him. He opened a bag of M&Ms and watched them float all around him, which he thought was really good because he's weightless for about 3 minutes, and came back and landed safely.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure for somebody who's in his line of work, this is like a peak experience.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. He said afterward, he sounded like he's ready now to retire. He's got what he wanted, and I don't blame him at all. Yes, this is absolutely... You know, it's interesting. Neil Armstrong was what was then not so rare. He was a civilian test pilot. It used to exist in this country, a large cadre of people who would do test pilot work for both the government and private companies like Boeing and Lockheed and McDonnell Douglas. For when they were building airplane and new airplane designs, you'd need civilian people who actually willing to risk their lives to do test flights. And that's kind of because there has been a significant lack of, I think, innovation and daring in American aviation industry in the last 30 years. That there's not that much work for test pilots. So for him, civilian test pilots. So for him, this is like a wonderful opportunity, and I bless him. Thank him for doing it.
One of the things that is interesting about this this particular craft is the way that it's powered. And I know in some of the reports, reporters have had fun with it, and they've said it's powered by laughing gas and old tires. Well, and I guess that's what it is. It's nitrous oxide and solid rubber, which is a little bit of a stretch, but that, you know.
Yeah,
you said it's okay. Not laughing gas and old tires, but is something about that the design of the engine and how it is fueled particularly novel?
That's a good question. It really comes down to Bert Rutan, the guy who designed the whole system. I mean, if you know anything about Rutan, he was the designer of Voyager, the plane that circled the globe nonstop on one fuel of gas, flown by his brother, Dick Rutan. And what Bert Rutan's interesting is that he's creative and very innovative. He doesn't do things as they are normally done. You just, it doesn't follow the typical path. He's creative. He, for example, White Knight, the first stage, which is essentially a plane that takes off, doesn't look like a plane like you used to. What he did is it's actually like he took two small gliders and stuck them together at one wingtip. So the left wingtip links to the right wingtip, of the two planes. Except in the middle there, he put the passenger cabin for the pilot, and then under that passenger cabin, he attaches Spaceship One. And so when you look at the pictures of this whole configuration, and the first time I looked at it on the web, at his website, it was a little hard to kind of figure out what I was looking at. It just doesn't look like you used to. He's innovative. He does things a little. He tries new things to see if he can come up with a more efficient way to do things. And he needs to have an engine that is lightweight, that is extremely efficient, but has a great deal of power, so that when you turn it on, you can obtain the speeds you need without having a lot of weight on the craft. And so, you know, try a different combination of materials instead of the standard stuff. And I'd say the rubber is interesting. It's like a solid rocket fuel. You're reducing the needs for certain kinds of fuel pumps. You know, you simplify it this way. So I'm not an engineer, so the very specifics, and once again, a lot of this is proprietary, he's not going to tell you. I mean, this is a side note, a little sidebar here. After the flight, a NASA official said, "This is just great. We need innovators like this to help us go to Moon and go to Mars," specifically NASA going to Moon and Mars. And I thought that was very funny, because Butrutin is not going to tell NASA anything he's figured out. It belongs to him. And so I can't tell you the specifics, but I mean I can make some guesses that the rubber provides him avoids fuel pumps and fuel line complications. He makes it much simpler.
There are apparently a number of teams around the world that have said that they're interested in competing for the X Prize, and according to what I read, maybe a half dozen that seem to really be serious contenders, and one of those is a Canadian team, and I think that there are some people who think that, in fact, it might be much more likely that it's the Canadians that will actually do it than the Rutan team. And I think also that the what I have read is that the people who were sponsoring the prize, the Ansari X Prize people, said that if no one does this by the first of the year, they're just going to retire the prize. So is the thinking out there in the world that follows this sort of thing that someone will do this and do it before the end of the year? And who do you think it will be?
Well, I mean, you know, now we're getting into the old let's speculate and predict. I would say that I had said this almost 6 months ago, based upon the technical design at the moment, I would say that Burt Rutan's company, Scaled Composites, is absolutely in the lead. I mean, they've done the test flight and actually accomplished the basic flight. So they just have to fix up some things and go for it. And I have no doubt that by the end of the year, someone's going to win this prize. The Canadian company, what's an interesting little side note to that, is that Dick Rutan, Burt Rutan's brother, works for X-Corps, the Canadian company. So this is actually a brotherly competition, a little sibling rivalry going on here. And what can I say? I mean, it's interesting. I think that it's going to be won by the end of the year without any question.
Our guest of this part of Focus 580 is Robert Zimmerman. He is an award-winning essayist. He's written a lot about exploration, about the exploration of space, and also in other sorts of ways. He's author of a recent book that looks at the history of the effort to construct and get into space a space station. And that book is titled Leaving Earth, and it's published by the Joseph Henry Press. It is out there in the bookstores now if you're interested in taking a look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome here this morning. We're talking about probably a few different things, current sort of space topics. But the one thing we're starting out talking here about is the effort to win the X Prize and the interest of a number of people around the world, different sorts of teams, the interest in putting a man in space and doing that as a privately funded effort. And I think that at the very least, they may not have qualified for this prize or going to be qualifying for this prize, but this team that we've been talking about actually did do it, and they did it last week on Monday. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I'm interested in what you think about some of what has been said about just the significance of this, and all of the blurbs that I have been reading from various people talking about, well, it's now only a matter of time, maybe 10 years, maybe more, that we will have space tourism, so that if you have the money, and it, I have seen figures like, you know, maybe as low as $10,000, yes, you could go on a ride like this.
Yes. I should just insert, David, that we actually, space tourism is not in the future. It's already happened.
Well, that's true.
Two guys have done it.
Yeah.
So it's already taking place. It's just a question of when the price will come down and the volume will increase.
Mm. So, but do you think that that is reasonable to think that within, you know, say 10, 15 years, there would be, it will be a possibility for someone, right, given that they have the money, that they could do it?
I think much shorter than that. I think without any question, much shorter than that. There have actually been a bunch of studies done indicating that the market does exist for this. There are plenty of people with spare cash that would love to be able to fly weightless. And suborbital flights are really right around the corner. I think that should someone win the X Prize this year, the excitement generated by that will produce a market and will produce business. I mean, you know, another side note to realize about Scaled Composites, Rutan's company, is that's financed by Paul Allen of Microsoft fame, one of the co-founders of Microsoft, and they had kept it very secret how much Allen had funded the company until the week of the flight, and at that point it was revealed that he spent about $20 million to put this company together, and I actually think he's been very smart and extremely shrewd. Dennis Tito flew as a tourist to the International Space Station for $20 million. But he got a flight, 8 days, and he was done. He got to fly. Paul Allen invested $20 million, and he's got a company which can not only make a profit, but maybe make the opportunity to do better. So I think, in a sense, it's a smart use of the money, and it's going to generate, again, excitement for doing this, not just simply for the opportunity to go to space, but to make money.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know exactly how you estimate these sorts of things, because I'm sure that they're not really going to tell you, but that and I've seen that same figure that Paul Allen put $20 million into the project. As I think some people have estimated, if you ask them, well, what do you think the price ticket was for this flight? The figure that I've seen is $100,000.
It's going to be, the market's going to determine a little bit. I'll give you another analogy. When I wrote Leaving Earth, I mean, I'm talking about the history of manned space exploration since Apollo, and much of that history talks about how the Russians and the turmoil the Russian space program went through when the Soviet Union collapsed. And when it initially collapsed, the Russians were trying to figure out what they should charge. They were no longer going to have free foreign astronauts go to Mir. They were going to now charge them for it. And they had a problem themselves trying to figure out, what do you charge? And it took them a while to figure out a number that would pay their costs, give them a profit, and be competitive on the open market. And that's what they came up eventually with, $20 million. And, you know, that number will shift depending on how much competition shows up along the way. And I think the same thing applies here. Trying to figure out what that number is going to be initially is hard. I mean, I've heard the numbers of $100,000 a ticket. I've heard $20,000 a ticket. I've seen $110,000 a ticket. I think it's really going to depend on the company and how much business there is. If there's a great deal of demand, if they announce, let's say, we're charging $10,000 a ticket and they suddenly have a wait list of 1,000 people, that price will change almost immediately and double or triple, you know. Yeah. They're going to see what the market will bear.
Well, aside from the possibility that this effort that we've been talking about would result in a thriving business of taking people for a ride in space, what exactly does it mean, or does it mean anything, for the larger American effort to be in space and to possibly get at some of these the goals that we're now talking about again, the possibility of having people go back to the moon, establishing some kind of long-term permanent presence on the moon, and then the big thing that seems so much, you know, that's big enough. Going to the moon is big enough, but some people are talking about going to Mars,
right.
And there the technical challenges are just that much greater. What does this really mean? Anything in terms of that bigger sort of project?
Oh yes, and I'll tell you what it is. When George Bush announced in January that he wants to refocus NASA's efforts towards exploration and going to the moon and then to Mars, refocus it from a hodgepodge of many vague things to focus on exploration as originally planned in the 60s, he then asked NASA to do it. He asked NASA to build the ships, to build the designs, to put the people in orbit, do all the work. And the simple fact is, from my perspective, is that I don't have much faith in NASA's ability to get that done. It's not that NASA's engineers are not brilliant. They are. But it's become a very overloaded bureaucracy. It's large. It's unwieldy. It can't get things done cheaply. And so, therefore, it's difficult for it to get the sufficient funds for anything to get accomplished. I mean, they spent, since the mid-late 80s, they spent more than $5 billion on blueprints for shuttle replacements and literally built nothing but a few prototypes. $5 billion. Well, think a minute. Paul Allen spent $20 million and got a plane that flew. They've had similar problems with the space station as well. And this is not, once again, an engineering question. It's not even a question of sincerity. They're not trying to screw anyone or the public. It's that it's a very overloaded bureaucracy. They've got to answer to Congress. They've got a lot of vested interests. I mean, this week, Sean O'Keefe held a press conference that I attended where he was specifically outlining a transformation for NASA. He's trying to restructure the bureaucracy, partly to answer the problems, these questions people have about NASA's unwieldiness. And if someone asked him the kind of question you just asked me, how does the Spaceships One flight influence NASA? And he says, well, you know, we can't do things for $20 million. We've got too many different people we've got to answer to, and the complexity is too large, so it costs too much money for us. It costs us a lot more to get things accomplished. What will happen with a flight like Spaceship One is that it demonstrates that you don't need NASA to get things accomplished. On top of that, one of the demands of the Aldrich Commission, which released its findings about a week ago, the same week of Spaceship One's flight, the Aldrich Commission was a commission that President Bush put together to deal with how NASA and the government should proceed on Bush's proposal to go to the moon and Mars. What kind of things needs to happen at NASA to change that agency to make the vision possible? And the Aldrich Commission, one of the things it suggested is that the government, NASA, should actually copy the XPRIZE and make awards in the range of anywhere from $10 million to $1 billion to private companies to try to accomplish any number of a variety of things. Now, they made the suggestion that, for example, $1 billion for the first private company that can send a ship to the moon and back. I think that wasn't very thought out on their part. $1 billion reward for a company that can provide cargo and crew transfer facilities, ferrying facilities to the International Space Station is very doable for private companies. And boy, you'd get 20 companies competing for that right away. And that's maybe a sign of how NASA can proceed much more efficiently than the way they're doing it now. In other words, we don't really need all the engineers working for NASA. We could actually fire them all. They'd put together their own private companies to compete for the prizes. And we'd not only get the vision and the space exploration going, but we'd get competing companies producing more space travel than we could know what to do with.
We have a caller here in a nearby community of Belgium. Let's talk with them. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes, sir. As we speak, many, many people are flying through our upper atmosphere with jets and everything. And when the Wright brothers did this, they never even thought about it. People flying by that many up there and adding the kind of pollution. With this first step we're taking into space, there's going to be a lot of rubber and nitrous oxide left in the upper atmosphere here if people start doing this on a regular basis, and that can't be very good for our environment. Anybody think about that?
Actually, I think the consequences are pretty inconsequential. I mean, there have been studies done by scientists and reported at American Geophysical Union conferences talking about how contrails had a very slight effect on the atmosphere, but actually the truth is it's been a very slight effect. I think that we don't know if the most efficient engines in the world will actually be the ones that Burt Rutan's company has come up with. There are plenty of other designs. I do not think that the consequences to the environment for launches are going to be very significant. No, I just don't see that as a concern. And the truth of the matter is, the solution to that is more technology. The amount of benefits, I mean, this is a spin-off thing, and I don't really get very excited about doing it. I mean, talking about it, but it's true that the benefits from space economically for the world are unimaginable. And just like the Wright brothers couldn't conceive of the benefits of air travel, we can't even conceive of the benefits of space travel right now. It's uncountable in terms of energy. And once you've got that, technology will solve the other problems that might spring up. Having to do with pollution. I don't believe in sticking our head in the sand and making believe that because there might be a problem, we should do nothing. I think that's very pessimistic.
Well, the point I'm trying to get is we might want to think the problems out first and then...
I believe in freedom. And the idea here is that you let people exercise some innovation and creativity and come up with solutions to the technological problems so that we can go in space. If you try to anticipate what problems might happen, you will basically regulate yourself into not accomplishing anything. And so I don't agree with that at all. I think we need to let people be creative and then recognize, then we'll find out then in the process of achieving this, we will find out where the problems are, because we don't know what the problems are going to be right now. When we know where those problems are, then you deal with it, then you solve it. But we won't know. We don't know until they actually start flying. I mean, I think it's foolish to try to anticipate it, because we'll be guessing wrong. You're always wrong. You don't know where these things are going to go, where the difficulties will be in advance. You just don't. It's impossible to even try.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me introduce again our guest, Robert Zimmerman. He is an essayist, has written a lot about exploration in different fields. He's author of a 1998 book titled Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8. He's written about space exploration, but other sorts of subjects, including paleontology and exploration in other fields. He's worked in the film industry. He's written and produced feature films, documentaries, commercials, and is author of a recent book, which is all about the space station effort, which is titled Leaving Earth, and it is published by Joseph Henry Press. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I do want to have you talk a little bit about the International Space Station, and which has been in the news some lately. People probably heard the story recently of the spacewalk, the scheduled spacewalk that ended up being canceled because there was a problem with the control of the oxygen supply for one of the astronauts. They have a couple of guys up there. It's the effort at the moment is kind of on hold because the shuttle has been grounded. It's partly built, and I guess that once again now, and as has happened before, people are asking questions about whether or not there's any purpose to build this thing, whether we should go ahead and finish it. And one thing we can say, I guess, is that the cost, it continues to go up all the time. I think the original estimate was something like $8 billion, and now they're saying more than $50 billion. What's the current status of the space station, and are there people seriously questioning whether or not we should even finish it?
Well, I think it would be one of the themes of Leaving Earth was to talk about how the International Space Station itself has problems because it was not conceived intelligently to begin with. The idea of going to, let's say, Mars, eventually doing real interplanetary exploration, you need to learn how to build vessels that can transport people to those places. That's what a space station is. It's a prototype interplanetary spaceship. That's what Wernher von Braun and Sergei Korolev, the designers in the 50s who end up doing the space race in the 60s, that's what they conceived space stations as prototype interplanetary spaceships. You're learning how to live in space for a long time, to create a vessel that can create a closed environment for you for a long time so you can travel to other places. In space stations at this stage of our technological development are how to learn how to do that. The problem with the International Space Station is it wasn't conceived initially with a clarity towards that goal. And for that reason, a lot of its design is not intelligent in that respect. You'd want to create a closed oxygen system and a closed water system if you were building a long-term space vessel. International Space Station was not built with that in mind. Therefore, it depends on the shuttle to bring up its water and its oxygen. Or it depends on the Russian half of the station to provide water and oxygen. That's one of the reasons the station can only hold two people right now, because without the shuttle, it doesn't have the systems in it to resupply the oxygen and water for more than two people continuously. However, once again, George Bush's proposal in January at least had, for the first time, an understanding of why a space station exists. And he said NASA's goals on the International Space Station will be focused towards learning the medical and engineering requirements to travel to other planets. And that, at least, is putting the proper focus on why you should do it. Now, until the shuttle can fly again, it's very difficult to get anything accomplished at the International Space Station, unfortunately. And they actually have a problem right now, because the station has three gyros. It was built with four gyros to orient it in space. One of those gyros failed about a year ago. Now, the plan had been to take a little over a year ago, actually before Columbia failed, the Columbia accident, this gyro had failed. And the plan had been that one of the next maintenance missions to the space station with the shuttle was going to bring a new gyro up, and they were going to replace the down gyro. So they've been working on three gyros, except one of those three gyros, basically a circuit breaker blew, a fuse blew on it, and they have to replace the fuse because it's not working now. So they're down to two gyros, which is the absolute minimum that the station can be oriented by gyro. If another gyro goes out, they're going to have to use thrusters and fuel to keep the station oriented so that its solar panels will pick up power from the sun. And that is going to be difficult to do because it's very costly in terms of fuel, and they can't haul that much fuel up. So they've got to get that gyro working, and they've been trying to do a spacewalk to do it. And this is once again getting back to the poor focus on the American half of the station. The American spacesuits, to repair the gyro, to replace the power unit on the gyro, they were going to go out of the American airlock, which is very close to that point, using American spacesuits. The American spacesuits, however, were designed to be refurbished on the ground. The shuttle would bring them up, the shuttle would bring them down to be refurbished, bring up new units, you know, exchange them using the shuttle. The shuttle's not flying. American spacesuits aren't working right now. They have a problem. They need to be repaired. They can't be repaired on board the station, so therefore they can't be used. So the solution is to use the Russian airlock to do the spacewalk. The Russian airlock is farther away. It makes the spacewalk a little more challenging. It doesn't make the spacewalk impossible by any means, or even unusual compared to the kind of walks that were done on Mir for many years. However, they need to do it. So they tried to do a spacewalk last week. Mike Fink, the American astronaut, the Russian suit is a very simply designed suit. It can be maintained in orbit reasonably well. The Russians periodically will send up a set of suits. When they finally wear out, they throw them out, essentially. They have four suits up there. The suits are adjustable to size. So what they did is they adjusted two suits to fit the two guys that are up there, Padulka and Fink. It takes a few days to get that adjustment right. They got the suits adjusted. Fink got into his suit. There's a switch that he's supposed to adjust in a certain position while he's getting the suit pressurized, and then he's supposed to switch it back to control the oxygen flow at the proper rate. He switched it back, but it didn't switch. He thought it would switch, but it didn't switch. And that's why the oxygen flow was leaving the suit much faster than it should have. So they had to abort the spacewalk, not knowing what the problem was. Once he got back inside and they looked it over, they realized, oh, that was the problem. He just has to make sure the switch is locked when he makes the switch. It's quicker to use this suit again than to reconfigure a different Russian suit to fit him. And so they're going to try to do the spacewalk on Wednesday. And I'm confident they won't have a problem. They'll make it happen. I think the International Space Station is essential. Let me rephrase that. It's not a question of whether the International Space Station is essential. I think if you want to eventually travel to other worlds, you need to learn how to live and work in space and over a long period of time, and you need to build the vessels to do that. And ISS gives at least an opportunity to do that kind of work, and so it should continue.
Well, when this project was first proposed, I think this was in the Reagan administration.
Yes, Reagan proposed it back in 1984, I think, in a State of the Union speech. Yeah. He proposed that he wanted the space station built by the end of the decade, 1990, and cost $8 billion.
Right, and so he was talking about it being finished in the early 90, so it's already 9 years past the point, you know, roughly speaking, a decade past the point where he said it should be finished. So it's not done. It's way off schedule. It's way over budget. Yeah. How much longer, how much more money does anybody think that it's going to take?
Well, you know, it's not going to – the actual cost of building right now isn't that much because a lot of the hardware is already built and is sitting in warehouses in Cape Kennedy. The Kennedy Space Center, Cape Canaveral. They built them. They're waiting for the shuttle to put them up. The Russian half, they have to build their parts. They've been, as they send up tourists, they make money, and they build more parts. The cost is flying the shuttles to do it. I think it would be a mistake not to finish it for a lot of reasons, you wouldn't save the money because a lot has been spent already. You would only take a defeatist attitude towards the problem by just canceling it without a replacement, without focusing on, well, we still need to learn how to travel in space for months at a time, so we're going to have to do it again if we don't do this. You see, one of the advantages the space station gives you is you can do, and this is an interesting conflict between the Russians and the Americans. Russians want to run year-long missions on the ISS because you need to learn how to live in space for more than a year to be able to travel to Mars. That means learning how to keep the muscles from deteriorating, learning how to deal with the fact that your bone density declines an average of about 0.5% per month in space. And how can you counter that? Because you don't want to lose so much bone density that you can't come back to Earth. You don't want to lose so much bone density that when you get to Mars, you can't work on Mars. So you have to learn how to solve those problems. And the Russians want to run year-long missions. If they do year-long missions, they can not only will they learn some of this information, but at the same time, they'll be able to sell more tourist flights and make some more money. And I think that's perfectly reasonable. NASA, being a bureaucracy, despite George Bush's proposal that we learn how to do this and we use the ISS to do it, is saying, no, 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 we won't do anything like that until the shuttle is back and flying. And I think that this conflict is an example of where NASA is once again very bureaucratic and fearful and doesn't really want to take risks. And the Russians have the right idea and want to do it. And the space station is a perfect place to find answer this question. How can the human body be adapted? What kind of food, what kind of medicine, what kind of exercises need to be done so that people can travel in space for long periods of time?
So what's anybody's best guess about when the shuttle will next fly?
Oh, that's a very good question. Your best guess is as good as mine. They are planning, they have said they have a tentative launch date of March of 2005. I am very pessimistic, once again, because of NASA's timidity these days, whether they will meet that date. I mean, they shouldn't fly whether they're ready or not, but they are putting standards upon themselves for safety that I think is just simply unrealistic in this context. This is space exploration. It is rocket science. It carries risk. You have to accept some of the risk. The astronauts accept the risk. They're not afraid to fly. They would like to mitigate the risks as much as possible, but they also recognize that if you try to mitigate the risks to an extreme, you'll never fly again. And based on what I've seen at NASA, I am fearful that they're putting standards of safety here that are just unrealistic, and it's going to make it impossible for them to fly. We shall see. Sean O'Keefe, he was giving testimony at a National Academy of Sciences committee that's looking into the Hubble Space Telescope situation about a week ago, and I was at that hearing, and he was talking about how they have 15 recommendations from the Columbia Accident Investigation Board that they have to meet before they can launch. And as far as he can tell, they have met 3 of those 15 at this point. And he says there's great difficulties about a bunch of others. And so we'll see. I can't answer the question. I don't think anyone can at this point.
We have a caller here. We're talking this morning with Robert Zimmerman. His book is Leaving Earth. It's about space stations and the quest to have that permanent presence there in space. It's published by Joseph Henry Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I've got about three general areas, but I have to comment on the the lack of any approach to having any kind of environmental impact statement, or at least some analysis, because what will happen, we'll if it goes ahead without examination, and there are ways of modeling, it isn't just guessing, that there'll be vested interests that want to keep whatever they're doing, and we have great examples of of that happening right now in the environment. We have vested interests that won't allow environmental facts actually to come out. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars, undermining global warming theories, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's that, and that's a basic diametric stance we have about regulation. Regulation can be a good thing. And I don't expect to reach agreement on that.
No, I don't think we will reach agreement on that. Having been to Russia and seen and talking to them and their own personal experience on heavy regulation and centralized bureaucracies, and seeing how NASA functions as a centralized bureaucracy and its inability to get anything
done. Well, that's hardly a fact. I mean, when they had military impulses or economical impulses, they actually didn't regulate their industry much at all. Is when they had national security to point to whatever they were doing. So that's hardly that's an old canard that doesn't work anymore, I hope, except for people who are have those Cold War images built into their psyche, like apparently you do. As far as NASA not being risk adverse or being risk adverse, I think sending a shuttle up that they can't even examine the outside of it. They had no provision for sending somebody out and looking around. They had evidence that there was some damage. So I think that, we've had this argument before. The dinosaur, which was sort of the small 2-4-person soaring device that the shuttle was outsized from, was actually a more reasonable approach. You send your payload up separately, and then you send the people up in a smaller, more reasonable small device, and I actually think that is something that we have agreed upon in the past, and when you were on a previous time.
It's true that the shuttle is not what NASA originally wanted. That was, once again, a very complicated compromise having to do with large bureaucracies and government and politicians.
And the military.
And I don't disagree with that.
Military impulse.
I would say that it's not a question here of being risk adverse or being willing to be a risk taker. In terms of flying the shuttle as they were, that was a case of very sloppy management and engineering. It was a case of letting the managers run things instead of the engineers, and that's not the same thing as being either willing to take risks or being risk adverse. Risk adverse, being so risk adverse that you can't do anything accomplished, is a case where you over-engineer things to such a point that you can't do it. That's being risk adverse. Willing to take risks is recognizing when there is a cost-benefit balance and some risks are worth taking because you need to fly. You need to learn.
Well,
you need
a complicated mechanism like a shuttle. Obviously, there's. It's hard to even start calculating the risk, but that's too general of a subject, so maybe I'll go to a specific point that I had, which is this latest flight that didn't get up to 100 clicks or 100K.
It didn't get up to 100 clicks, just beyond 100K.
Right. It got up to 66, you were saying, just barely. It only went Mach 3, and it has to go 25 to go into orbit. Isn't that right? Where is the rest of the energy coming from?
Wait. So you understand. An XPRIZE doesn't require orbit, one. Two, you misunderstood. I said it went up to just over 62 miles, which is just over 100 kilometers, which it did make that same number. It does not, for the win the XPRIZE, you don't have to get up to orbit. So in this respect, it's a suborbital flight, but it puts you in space.
Well,
I'm
not talking about the prize so much. I'm talking about the idea of actually having a private space program that could put people into orbit and could put people into space stations, et cetera. You do need 25K.
Yes, absolutely correct.
25 Mach.
Yeah, absolutely correct. This spacecraft, the Spaceship One, is not an orbital craft. It's going to do an orbital craft is going to require a complete redesign. There's no question of that. But the design, as done, is actually harking back to the original concepts that NASA had back in the 70s for the shuttle, two-stage reusable craft. It gets you only up to suborbital speeds, granted, but it's proof of concept once again. It's once again getting us closer to the suborbital, to the orbital reusable craft that the shuttle was originally conceived as, a smaller, multi-staged, reusable, series of reusable stages. But once again, it has to be completely redesigned. There's no question of that. I'm not the engineer to do it.
Let me get to the point I was trying to get to.
I focus on writing about what other people accomplish, and there are engineers out there that will do this. I have no doubt.
Well, to get near Mach 25, you need a great lift vehicle, and that's where the big bucks are. And it looks to me like the Defense Department is actually one of the reasons they want to talk about a civilian program again is because they want to be able to put off the expenses of designing these new really great lift vehicles, less comparable to the Russians Proton, though obviously much more sophisticated. But that's what you need to really get in orbit, and that is super big bucks. And it just seems to me this is a different subject entirely if you're talking about suborbital. And I really go back to the idea that environmental impact statement is not a outmoded regulatory device. I mean, we really need to be looking at what the long-term implications of this would be. I'm for going to other plants and researching, and I don't think I have this idea that a lot of scientists have, which is that the manned part of it isn't the most important. There's some absolutely astonishing things going on with robotic devices, et cetera, so I think we can all participate in that fashion. And I find it actually satisfying. I just think that we're going back to arming the heavens, and that it's hard to not talk about the idea of going back into space without talking about the greater project of the U.S. and mainly the Defense Department of arming the heavens. So obviously that's a lot, but
Mr. Zimmern, you want to comment on any of that?
I mean, that's a whole different show. Without any question. I would point out several things. One, American companies Boeing and Lockheed actually do have launchers that can exceed the tonnage into orbit of the Proton, Russian Proton, 28 tons. I think it's the Delta can send up. Secondly, once again, one of the reasons it's big bucks to get a heavier launch vehicle that can bring humans into orbit in the range of like 10 to 20 tons is partly because the government is spending the money and there is no competitive effort to keep the costs down. There's an interesting company right now that's financed by Elon Musk, who was the co-founder of PayPal. He sold PayPal to eBay, got $1 billion+ for the sale. He's a 28-year-old guy, 29 years old. He founded a company called SpaceX. He wants to grab some of the market share of the launch industry. He wants to grab it back, actually, from the Russians, who've taken it from Boeing and Lockheed, who have not been competitive on the open market. They are quite happy to be overpaid for launch services by NASA and the military and not try to reduce costs of their launch services. For that reason, the communications industry has basically turned to the Russians because they're cheaper and they're competitive. So Elon Musk, with his SpaceX company, is designing the Falcon 1 rocket. They're going to do their first launch later this year. They're coming up with a Falcon 5, which is a much heavier lift vehicle, and they have contracts to send up crafts later next year. And they're going to build these rockets at a fraction of the cost that Boeing and Lockheed spends for their heavier lift vehicles and take some of that market back. And when you do that, you suddenly find that maybe a heavy lift, not heavy lift, it's the wrong term, a heavier lift, a larger rocket that could get you a human craft to orbital speeds is not as expensive as you think. It's once again a question of being innovative and a little bit of creative and a little bit of competitiveness to find a way to do it less expensively.
We'll have to leave it there because we're at the end of the time. Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time again.
No, my pleasure. You know, I'm always glad to come back.
All right. Robert Zimmerman is our guest. Again, his most recent book, if you're interested, is titled Leaving Earth, Space Stations, Rival Superpowers, and the Quest for Interplanetary Travel. It's published by Joseph Henry Press.